Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome, and thank you so much for joining me. This is episode number 1065. Today, our guest will be George Gilder. He is returning to the show. We might have him as a speaker announcement at one of our upcoming events, so stay tuned for that. George Gilder, you may have heard him on our show before. He also is a bigwig in the thought leadership industry for investing and the stock market and technology, and he's written many, many books on all of these subjects. So we will touch on at least the first half of his interview today, maybe the whole thing, depending on how long we go, because to help me do the intro here, we have our returning guest, Doug, who, when you put Doug and I in a room, it is never a brief conversation. Doug, welcome. How are you?
I like to think there's never a dull moment either.
And it's
other
never
people may
moment.
Disagree.
Yeah, no, I think it's never a dull moment for sure. But Doug, you are an idea man, and you have some great ideas. You really do. And one of the ideas that you know, we kind of feed off of each other really well, I think. So I'm glad to have you involved in our thought and content creation world here. So it's good to have you involved in all this thought creation and content creation over the years. You had a new idea for a new interactive exercise for our investors, and you are going to be hosting this in Hawaii at our Profits in Paradise event. I'm super excited about it. And this is called the Wealth Simulator. The Wealth Simulator. So if you've ever taken flying lessons, or if you've ever played SimCity and you've used a simulation exercise, that's what this is about, but this is very real world, so I love it. Tell us about it, Doug.
Sure thing. So I actually got the idea for this from some of the old pen and paper-based role-playing games that I used to play when I was younger. And so for some of the nerdier folks in your audience, now if you have folks in your audience who are cool, this may not speak to them. For anybody who's a fan of like Monty Python movies and things like that, this will probably really speak to them. But my whole thought is that the way most pro formas lay things out is they'll say, okay, well, we're going to say that the property appreciates at 6% a year. And we're going to say that there's 8% vacancy. And we're going to say blah, 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 blah. But that's not how real life works. The way real life works
it does not.
Is...
it varies.
Yeah, exactly.
It varies.
Yeah, the way real life works is your appreciation averages 6%. Some years it's 3. Some years it's 8. Some years it's minus 10. Other years it's plus 25.
And it also depends, of course, where you invest and what type of property class you're investing in and a whole bunch of factors. But yeah, you know, 6 is a commonly referred to reference point for appreciation rates. Okay, go ahead.
Exactly. And so what happens is when you put a portfolio together, you're not going to have a stable linear increase. There'll be some markets that have trouble. There'll be some properties that have trouble. There'll be some markets that do outstanding. There'll be some properties that just you never have any problems with at all. And the thing that I want to help demonstrate with this game is how when you put a portfolio together, you have exposure to both some of the upside and some of the downside. You deal with the downside so that you have a chance to experience the upside. And so what happens is when you put that into a whole portfolio and then run it through a simulation of multiple years of turning tenants, of experiencing market simulations, maybe of saying, hey, do we want to do a refinance to pull cash out, things like that, what we can do is we can start to see, you know, when you give a portfolio time, it really can help make you very wealthy. Because I know that you've done your, say, refi till you die simulations, which are pretty high level. And this is really taking it down to a more granular level.
This is a more, like a game. More a nuts and bolts kind of hands-on, very real world thing. Because,
exactly.
You know, take the issue of tenant turnover, right? And this is just all over the board. You know, sometimes you turn a property and it's really easy. You know, you move one tenant out, you might take a little bit of money out of their security deposit. You move a new one in 3 days later and it's beautiful. But other times it's terrible. You know, you have a tenant who's done a bunch of damage. You've got some normal wear and tear. You've got the property manager who has a different alignment of interest that's not necessarily aligned with you, that may or may not be willing to debit the tenant's security deposit as much as they should or you want them to. And so there are all these issues, right? And that turnover could be more expensive. And you've got to kind of average this out. But I think when you look at it from the long term with the wealth simulator game, it really helps us focus on the big picture. And it helps us as investors get over those bumps in the road that feel all too significant when we're there. But looking back, they're like a little pebble in your shoe. They're no big deal, right?
Exactly. And one of the things that I'm also looking to do with the Wealth Simulator is, of course, right, to simulate the different types of properties, different markets. So, for example, one of the things I'll be building in is that if you're investing in higher end properties, you're going to have less onerous tenant turnovers. Your lower end properties, your C's, and well, we don't really do C minuses, but your B minus and C properties are going to look better on paper, but you're going to have more frequent problems to deal with. And so I think one of the things that'll be really interesting is to see, based on the makeup of the different teams, some people might have more of a risk appetite and they're going to say, hey, if I get a bunch of C properties, they're probably not all going to be a disaster at once. And they'll say, I'm going to go for the higher cash flow. Other people might say, I'm going to go for some of the A and B properties because I want better stability and more predictability. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that I'm really looking to see play out, you know, not just to see who can win, but also to be able to see, hey, when you implement different strategies, how do they play out differently? Mm-hmm. Because the way that we're going to be building the simulation is frankly based on a random number generator, because mm-hmm. as much as everybody likes to pretend that they can predict the future, they
right.
can't.
Yeah,
I can't, you can't, nobody can. Is it completely random? Not necessarily, but I can't predict it and nobody is any good at it.
Yep. Good point. Okay, good. Doug, I can't wait to play the Wealth Simulator game with everybody at our Hawaii event. Of course, this is Profits in Paradise. This is coming up the first week of November. We've never had an event in Hawaii before. We've never had an event like this before. We've added to our kind of event and conference catalog over the years, starting many years ago with Creating Wealth. Certainly the most attended event ever yeah. because it's been going for so many, you know, for like 14 years. And then we added Jason Hartman University or JHU. Before that, we had Meet the Masters. And now we have a whole new event with new content, new points of view. We also, you know, are many years into a pretty booming real estate market here. And I think that begs the question, are we on the precipice of a change? And so we're going to talk about how to deal with that possibility. Now that, you know, we've all been through it many times, or at least, you know, we have on our team. Maybe you haven't in the audience, but you'll hear about that. So really excited about this event. Go to jasonhartman.com to get your tickets if you haven't done so already. And Doug, any final thoughts before we get to George Gilder?
I think just the main thing for your customers to think about is that it's a really great idea to come to these events because every time there's a little bit of a different spin. So it's easy to say, okay, yeah, I've heard all that before. I know it.
Right.
But even if you hear something where most of it you've heard before, the way that your mind is oriented will make you think of things that hadn't occurred to you before. Mm-hmm. That's actually one of the reasons why I have an Audible subscription. I download audiobooks and I'll listen to a lot of books 3, 4, 5, 6 times.
Oh, yeah.
Because every time I listen to them, I always learn something new or mm-hmm. I learn how to implement something in a way that didn't occur to me the first time I listened to it, or yeah. I'll catch something else. So even if you've been to Creating Wealth before, even if you've been to JHU Masters, it's a really great idea for you to come to Profits in Paradise because there's going to be some new content and also content that's presented in a different way that will help you to develop different ideas. Because yeah. one of the things that I think is really important for people to understand is the value of an idea. An idea that you don't put into action, first of all, is worth nothing. But the thing is, if you do put ideas into action and you get an idea that you didn't have before that's really valuable, it can be a multiple of hundreds of times what you paid to go to the conference.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds.
Yeah.
Ideas can be just tremendously valuable. So one of the things that really impactful people do is go out and expose themselves to opportunities to acquire new ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. Very good point. And it is an at least partially tax-deductible vacation, you know, so that's good. And then, obviously the networking, so powerful. You see people that are really doing it. You meet people that are really doing it. We'll share many meals together at this event. So that's always super valuable. Adding on to your thought, Doug, I remember many years ago when I was listening to a cassette tape of Earl Nightingale, the late great success teacher. He talked about that idea. He said the reason you really need to use the repetitive technique is that every time when we're listening to something, say we're at a conference and, I'm up there talking about this, that, or the other thing, or you're up there talking about this, that, or the other thing, when you hear a new idea that you haven't heard before, and Earl Nightingale did this as the metaphor, he said, it's like picking up the tone arm on a record player. We're using some old examples here.
Using some old metaphors.
Exactly. But of his day, that was certainly true. So the record keeps spinning. The arm is up because now your mind is thinking about that new idea. Oh, how could I implement this? What about that? Is that really true? Does it apply to me? Does it apply to not apply to me? Whatever. Your mind is thinking about all of that, and you're not listening to what immediately follows that idea because now you've gone into your own head, right? And then mm-hmm. when you listen again, you hear the stuff that immediately followed because the new idea didn't distract you from it. And so you pick up the tone arm, the record keeps spinning and going by underneath, and that's the importance of repetitive learning. We've always said that people should come to at least two of our events every year because they will learn so many new things, even if it's the same event, right? Even if it's Creating Wealth or JHU over and over. We don't do Masters or Profits in Paradise over and over like that. But they will learn new things. There's no question about it. They will definitely learn new things every single time. So very important to come. Yeah.
And one of the things that I found is that I learned probably more from the other people who are at events than the actual content of the event. So even if the content is identical, which is never the case, the people will be different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the people are who you're really going to learn from.
Absolutely. Good point. Yeah. The networking is a huge part of it. So Doug, I'm glad you mentioned all that. And thank you for the big idea on the Wealth Simulator game. I can't wait. We're going to do it in Hawaii. The Portfolio Builder game has always been a big hit, the one that we do at JHU. But this is an entirely new, very real world concept. So looking forward to it. And I will see you there. Folks, let's get to at least the first half today of George Gilder. It's my pleasure to welcome a returning guest back to the show. He's been on several times before, and I've been following his work for a good 20 years or so. I originally had the pleasure of meeting George Gilder on a cruise, a Forbes investor cruise through Scandinavia and Russia many years ago. And I saw him speak there and got to hang out with him. And it's a pleasure to have him back on the show. He's co-founder and senior fellow at the Discovery Institute. He's original pillar of supply-side economics, former speechwriter for President Ronald Reagan, author of the classic book on economics, Wealth and Poverty, the New York Times best-selling author of The Scandal of Money, Why Wall Street Recovers But the Economy Never Does, and author of the new book, Life After Google, The Fall of Big Data and the Rise of the Blockchain Economy, as well as many other books. George, welcome back. How are you?
Great to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you. So Google, and now you may disagree with me on this and feel free to, but I believe that Google and Facebook are two of the scariest companies on earth. They influence way too much. They have way too much control. Any company that controls 65-70% of the global internet traffic, either number one needs to be busted up under antitrust, or number two needs to be regulated like a utility, or number three needs to make their algorithms open source so we can see what they're up to. I don't know. What is Google Marxism, George?
Google Marxism repeats the original era of Karl Marx. Karl Marx's basic mistake was to imagine that the machines of the Industrial Revolution were kind of the final human accomplishment, that from then on, after the factories and turbines and steam engines and beginnings of electricity, railroads of the Industrial Revolution, the only challenge would be to redistribute wealth, that the problem of creating wealth had been solved. Mm-hmm. And today, Google makes the same claim, even more grandiosely. They say that their technologies, their artificial intelligence, their machine learning, their robotics, their biotech, their search engines and solution engines, maps, and all the miraculous inventions that Google has provided the world are the final human accomplishment, because we're headed for a singularity where Google's machines are going to be smarter than any humans, and humans won't even be able to comprehend them. And all we can do is retire to various beaches and receive a guaranteed annual income while the new masters of the universe fly off to nearby planets with Elon Musk in a winner-take-all universe. Mm-hmm. And I just think this is a delusional philosophy. Mm-hmm. It's Google Marxism, and it is a typical error that technologists always make of exaggerating the significance of their own creations. Mm-hmm. Artificial intelligence is a wonderful technology. Well, it creates jobs. It makes human beings more productive and thus more employable. It's a good thing, but it doesn't usurp human minds. Artificial intelligence is impossible without real human intelligence.
Yeah, yeah, very, very interesting. What do you think about, you believe that Google is sort of at the peak of its power right now, sounds like. I mean, are they going to be actually toppled? It's hard to imagine that any company as powerful as Google and you know, say Facebook too. I don't know if you include that in your thinking here, but I'd be curious about that.
Sure.
One. Yeah.
You know, 10 years ago in 2008, the four leading companies in the world in market cap were Walmart, Exxon, China Petroleum, and China Industrial and Commercial Bank. 10 years later, the four biggest companies in the world are Apple, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft. This is a tremendous triumph for American information technology. It's completely unpredicted. I'm just saying that in 10 years, these companies are going to be displaced by new companies that supply a new architecture for the internet based on the cryptographic innovations that are occurring around the world in the wake of Bitcoin and Ethereum and NEO and EOS and all these new foundations for internet security and internet transactions without the ridiculous circus of usernames and passwords for every website on the planet, all assuming that they're the apple of your eye. They're the only website you have. So, of course, you know your username and password and the stupid security questions they ask and all the other personal data they require for you to transact on their page.
Well, look, you know, most people think of Google as a search engine. Obviously, Alphabet, maybe we should be talking about Alphabet, the parent company. It's many things. They're into all sorts of stuff, robotics, AI, search, you know, zillion other things, self-driving cars, etc. But, I mean, most people experience Google as a search engine. That's what they really think of, and maybe the
Well, that's
the
what
G
they
Suite
do. 95% of their revenues still come from their search engine.
Right.
Advertising sold on the basis of information collected through their search engine. That's 95% of their revenues. Since most of their products are free, they don't submit to the usual disciplines of a capitalist economy. So their learning process may be slower than an ordinary company experiences that has prices to convey to them the real conditions in their marketplace. Google has virtually no ordinary customers.
Right.
It avoids security liabilities to their customers by giving away their search for free.
Right. What you said before, you know, the fact that Google doesn't really have that, and many other companies are in the same position, they don't have that typical feedback mechanism that most businesses have to have because they're not so overfunded and over wealthy, right? You know, Google is kind of immune to the typical business environment. Many other companies are in the same place.
It's not that they're overfunded. Yeah. It's that they had an absolutely brilliant coup in advertising. Mm-hmm. They understood the lesson of life after television, which was my book written in around 1990 with subsequent editions, which predicted the computer of the future would be as portable as your watch, as personal as your wallet. It would recognize speech. It would navigate streets. It would collect your news and your mail. Just might not do windows.
Mm-hmm, right.
It'll do doors.
Yeah, right.
And Steve Jobs read the book and passed it out to his colleagues. So I think I had some minor role in the rise of these smartphones that I called teleputers back in the day.
And teleputers, I love it, yeah. Very reminiscent of the tricorder on Star Trek. You know. What is the future of search then, for example?
Well, Google is already abandoning search.
Mm-hmm.
Google is moving from search to solutions.
Mm-hmm.
They're focusing on employing artificial intelligence, sort of transhuman artificial intelligence, and the collection of virtually all the data in the universe to be able to answer all questions themselves. So their ultimate goal is to use big data and concentrated data centers and in the clouds to, in a godlike fashion, deliver answers to all your questions better than the answers you could summon yourself.
Yeah, something else.
And better than the answers than any other web page. Now they crawl the web to offer your answers, but in the future, their artificial intelligence will allow them to generate answers themselves.
Mm-hmm. Tell us how that looks. I mean, how will the internet, you're a futurist, a technologist, you're all kinds of things, really, a financial guy. How will the world look in 10 years, 5 years? You know, what will our experience be like versus the way it is today with blockchain influencing technology so much?
The blockchain reverses this whole Google empire. The Google model is a kind of porous pyramid where in search of security, they concentrate all the data in a bunch of giant data centers deployed near rivers and glaciers and in the mountains around the world. And the idea that centralization will offer security. And this is a kind of poor, but centralization, they discover, is not safe. It tells the hackers where the information is and what information is important. So the blockchain reverses this model. Rather than concentrating all the information in one place, they distribute it across all the nodes of the network. And they make each individual participant the master of his own data, his own identity, his own content. And so rather than having to learn thousands of usernames and passwords in order to transact across the internet, you have one username and one private key that applies to yourself. As your DNA is unique, your identity is unique. And that one identity can be used at any of the resources or sites across the net. Mm-hmm. And so it moves the internet from a porous pyramid where all the money and power rises to the top, to Google and Amazon and whatever, to a bottom-up internet where individuals control their own content and identity and security.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so another part of that is something that we've probably all heard talked about a little bit, and it's this idea all of our information should be owned by each individual. We should own our own information rather than Facebook owning some of it, Google owning some of it, LinkedIn owning some of it. And then when we move around through cyberspace, our information would just go with us, and we would allow sharing and unsharing, and we could revoke permission at any time. What do you think of that idea? Will it work? And what does it really look
like in practice? It'll work. Yeah. It makes sense. The current system is broken down. There's no security on the internet. The big companies like Google's only answer is to dispatch SWAT teams against the hackers across the net, or ask for more usernames and passwords, or harass you with more security messages that are just irritating and distracting and cannot readily be differentiated from actual hacks. So the current security model is broken, and the only response of Facebook and Google at all is to ask for yet more passwords and maybe more PINs and ultimately iris scans and face recognition schemes and ultimately your DNA. So they just don't have an answer. The security is broken down, and what the cryptocosm offers, that is this new efflorescence of creativity in the wake of Bitcoin and Ethereum, is a new architecture for the internet, where the individual is in control, where the data is distributed the way human minds are distributed. The only thing that gives any meaning to any of these technologies is the individual human mind. That's what it's all about. And the idea that somehow the technology is going to blast out of control of human beings is just delusional.
Mm-hmm. George, how far away are we from this kind of change? This sounds pretty major. It sounds like a tectonic shift.
Well, it's a tectonic shift. It'll also be a new monetary system for the world economy at the very moment when the existing global monetary system is cruising toward a crash of some kind with $250 trillion of global debt. 4 or 5 times all global GDP. I mean, it's just an unsustainable system created to endow the central banks with the ability to impose the burdens of today on tomorrow and in behalf of existing incumbent politicians. The biggest industry in the entire world economy, bigger than anything else, is currency trading. It's $5.1 trillion a day. It's 73 times all world trade in goods and services. It's 25 times all world GDP. And it doesn't even produce reliable or authentic monetary values. All it does is allow central banks to stick the bills of today on our children. It's happening now. I mean, it's something that's an ongoing process. You know, the biggest problem of the U.S. economy, from my point of view, is the collapse of initial public offerings. They've dropped 90% in the last 20 years. The stock market is only half as large in number of public companies as it was before. Most of these public companies are buying up their rivals rather than accommodating IPOs or buying up their own stock at a rate of some $40 billion a month. It's really a carnival of bunkum out there. It's called a stock market boom, but it's in fact a real crippling of the public markets and reduction to a few hundred favored companies that hedge funds buy in and out of at a rate of millions of times a second.
That would be a sign of more centralization and more winner-take-all type of situation, right?
It's the rise of the administrative state that really accounts for this collapse of entrepreneurship. But there's no entrepreneurial collapse in communist China, surprisingly enough. I've just come back from communist China, where they've just published Life After Google, and 12 different publishers bid on it. the entrepreneurials, they have three times as many IPOs as we do in China now. They got comparable levels of venture capital and whole efflorescence of innovation. It's really impressive. And we in the United States are trying to catch up, essentially. But we still have virtually no IPOs. And the SEC is contemplating extending to ICOs the same kind of paralysis that reduced IPOs by 90%.
Well, it's ICOs, bad policy. Yeah. There's some bad stuff going on in the ICO world, I think. But I don't know. You might disagree with me. But, I mean, has crowdfunding filled the void on some of that?
Of course there's bad stuff. Yeah. There's bad stuff going on around the world. Bad stuff is a reflection of human behavior everywhere.
But
the $20 billion of ICOs over the last 12 months on the Ethereum platform, contrived in the last 5 years by a Vitalik Buterin, a teenage genius, really, lured out of college by Peter Thiel's fellowship. Mm-hmm. That $20 billion to thousands and thousands of new cryptographic startups has saved the entrepreneurial economy in the United States and across the world. It's been a great achievement. And yes, a lot of them have gone bust. Some of them are spectacular scams, rather readily exposed. But it's the future of the internet, and it's really unstoppable, I believe, now.
What you were just talking about reminded me of something I want to ask you more about, one of your thoughts here about insider trading. You have an unusual angle, an unusual belief on that. You talked about it on one of my shows before when I interviewed you. Tell us your thoughts on insider trading, if you would.
The only trading that's significant, that's valuable investment, is insider investment. The government's position, which is paralyzing and stultifying public markets, is that it's illegal to invest in anything you know about.
Mm-hmm.
The government actually wants you to invest in
things you don't know about.
State lotteries.
Right. Yeah.
And however, all the returns still go to the insider traders. I mean, there's a bifurcated returns in the U.S. investment scene. On one end are venture capitalists who never invest in anything unless they have intimate knowledge of every nook and cranny of the company. That's venture capitalists on one side who capture most of the return for entrepreneurship. And then on the other end are big conglomerates from Warren Buffett to General Electric to whatever it is, to Google and Facebook, which are buying up companies by the hundreds. None of these companies ever make an investment without intimate knowledge of all the inside details. And it's only the public in the middle that is
that doesn't
relegated
get to know
to these
right.
banal public statements by companies filtered through PR firms
right. yeah.
and law firms where all the information is essentially filtered out.
That's really interesting. I mean, that's an interesting view. I think you have something there. Now, interestingly, I believe it's, I was reading an article once years ago about how insider trading is actually legal in either maybe New Zealand or Australia. Do you know about this?
I don't actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think we have the most oppressive insider trading environment because all the investors are terrified by Preet Bharara and prosecutors like him. He's the leader who run their computers through all the trading data. And if there are any anomalous returns, they're marked as suspicious and investigated. Essentially, this has just intimidated the whole investment community. And they're all driven to computer trading. At least Preet hasn't indicted a computer as yet. This is the way trading happens. And you get these egregious 40% per year returns for hedge funds that are trading through Flash Boys and quantitative trading and all these empty models that succeed only by trading faster than the market can move. So they essentially get to front run without actually front running. The computer does thousands of trades a second long before you can compete before someone can click a mouse.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, yeah. It's ridiculous. It's impossible to compete. Wrap it up with any of your thoughts about the future, your new book, whatever you like, and give out your website too.
Well, just Life After Google offers a very hopeful perspective on this amazing upsurge of creativity around the world. And it's already addressed our problem of IPO doldrums. It's addressing the problem of world money and with efforts to simulate gold in new digital forms that can allow a rise of a new global money that serves as a measuring stick rather than as a magic wand for central bankers. It addresses the security crisis on the internet, where the only answer is more usernames and passwords and security questions.
Yes, that stuff bugs you as much as it does me. See, George, I think usernames, passwords, and leaf blowers are some of the most annoying things in the world. Yeah, you like the leaf blower thing. See, that's a technology that needs to go away. It was one of the worst inventions ever.
The real leaf blowers are those computers doing currency trading in all the banks around the world.
Yeah.
$5.1 trillion of leaf blowing that doesn't even provide us a measuring stick of a stable currency at the end of the day or even at the end of the second. That's what the cryptocosm offers. I wrote about the microcosm, which was the rise of the computer chip back in the early 1980s.
And you wrote about the telecosm and the blogosphere.
The rise of the internet and fiber optics. And this is the new economy emerging today, the cryptocosm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good stuff.
Life after Google.
Uh-huh. Well,
will be life after Google. Google says there won't be life after Google, that we'll all retire to beaches.
I say
that humans still have a role in the future.
Well, that's
creative in the image of their creator.
Right. That's encouraging. George Gilder, thanks again for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the interview.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.